All right, good morning, Bruce. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. And to everyone.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Here we go. Year two, maybe, of this book, Kenneth Wapnick's The Journey Home.
at least the second year. We started it in November 2018.
Wow.
Or maybe December. So we're in calendar years on the third year, but just a little over 1 year in terms of elapsed time, I think.
That's pretty cool. It's pretty cool that we just do this every week. And I was thinking that this morning, all the different things that I do every week, and the days seem to go one right after the other, as if they were really just following along in a reasonable path, and yet none of it is actually happening in that way at all. Everything that we're experiencing happened a long time ago, and we're only watching something that is dead, static, just sitting here not moving at all. but it's the idea of time that makes it appear to be moving. It's a crazy thing, and it's the intervals of time, just like a movie camera, a film. It's going through a frame at a time. Each frame is static. It is not changing. It's not becoming different. Nothing's happening. One right after the other, after the other, after the other, and together they make a cohesive story. But in reality, not one single one of them is really the whole. It's not real. But it's the motion. It's the intervals that make it appear to be happening now.
So the flickering of the mind, if you will.
Of an
insane mind in this case.
exactly.
And but we don't see that most of the time.
So. No. It's the thoughts that we have about what is that we're seeing that actually makes it appear to be real. Today's lesson is a really good one. We're in January 4th, lesson 4, and we're beginning in the workbook to look at our thoughts. And I love how subtly, Jesus starts us off, thinking about, what we see and then what our thoughts are. And then he kind of smooths us over into, and all there is about any of this is your thought.
These thoughts do not mean anything. They're like the things I see in this room, on the street, from this window, in this place.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Because they're all the idea. You get right off the bat from the earliest workbook lessons that it's all about generalizing. But we need the practice and the repetition. I think it's so great that you talked about in a couple different contexts that the repetition of doing things over and over and over again. It thought across my mind the other day, and I'm going to share a little slightly nerdy idea.
You nerdy? What not?
I basically years ago I looked at a website by Trimble, who was some of the early pioneers of GPS technology. And nowadays we take it for granted that our phones and the dashboard devices and newer cars can give us guidance and direction to get where we want to go using this network of satellites that are in geosynchronous orbit around the planet that all have beaming signals and with astonishing accuracy that allow us to determine where we are. Well, what's really one of the many interesting things in this tutorial that I watched was that not only does it take four or five satellites in order to get the accuracy that's needed, because they're all comparing and calculating and fine tuning and refining moment to moment, but it's the repetition that actually allows these devices that we carry in our pockets and have in our cars and elsewhere that give us the ability to pick up a signal that is incredibly faint. In fact, it's so faint, for the nerds in the audience that you know might get this, is it's I think it's 10 or 20 decibels below the noise floor, which means that if you were to look at a graph of the signal that the GPS is using and on an oscilloscope that was picking up the antenna signal, you wouldn't be able to see it at all. It's below the level of noise. So the only way that this works is by repetition. Because the GPS devices that pick up the GPS signals that are transmitted are basically trained, if you will, or programmed to look for a very specific pattern, they can gradually pull that pattern through repetition out of the noise because they detect it using a statistical, statistical meaning over and over again. And if you get enough instances of that particular pattern, even though it's down below the noise, you can lock onto it. You can lock onto something that is so quiet that it'd be kind of like if you walked into a room and there were dozens of people shouting next to you, and then there was somebody from across a very large hall that was whispering. You would be able to ignore all the people that were shouting and listen to the person that's whispering.
Wow.
And that's basically what it amounts to. In other words, the noise of the stuff that is the background noise is so strong that it requires the statistical technology that grabs the signal from below the noise floor, as it's called, and then turns it into through repetition. It looks, sees it, and statistically says, yep, that's what I want. And then it finds that pattern and locks onto it. And that's what it uses from that point on. Give you your coordinates. And so a lot of times if you turn on your GPS, it'll say acquiring satellites or some little message like mm-hmm. that when you first turn it on. What that means is it's actually doing, several seconds of statistical analysis, which means billions and billions of data points as it's grabbing this super high frequency signal and statistically figuring out, What am I listening to, and which satellites am I getting a strong enough signal to lock onto, and then using that data from then on. But it's fascinating to me that it's I think a great metaphor. Not only is the GPS a great metaphor, as Tomas Vieira, I think, was my first introduction to that metaphor a few years ago when he gave a workshop in Ashland, Oregon, and was sharing how it's sort of like the Holy Spirit is our inner GPS, and because the Holy Spirit doesn't berate us when we miss a turn or go off on the wrong off-ramp off the freeway instead of waiting for the correct one or whatever. It basically just says, well, now to get where you need to go, you go here. And, recalculating. And then the fact that we have to do it over and over and over again is kind of like the GPS's, repetition. Yeah. It's in order to generalize, we have to repeat the mindfulness that the course mind training program recommends over and over and over again until we see, oh, I can see peace instead of this. I'm not upset for the reason I think. Oh, I'm looking at this as a separate interest rather than a shared interest. Or I momentarily forgot that my real purpose here is to be kind and to understand that, we're all in it together and that peace is really that our true identity and all the things that the course shares, but it takes that repetition, doesn't it?
It does, and it takes. First off, it takes. We have to learn what the signal is that we're looking for.
Exactly.
And so, what we're doing in these first lessons actually is we're honing in on the signal. We're figuring out which it is that we're looking for, and then and then the repetition, as you say, that's what. That's what brings it more and more our experience, because what we're experiencing here is an accumulation of our thoughts. The only experience that I have of this world, of anything here, is what I think about it. And so, if I'm thinking, that's the only way I even know anything about it. is my thought about it. And so when Jesus is telling us, okay, now look at these thoughts and recognize they don't mean anything, you know, that you know, all of the things that you thought they meant don't mean anything. And that's his way of saying, you know, go past the noise to the real signal that you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
You know, forget the noise, forget the events, forget the stories, forget the things, you know, forget the feelings, forget all of these things. He's in the lesson, he even says, even the good thoughts are shadows.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that really helps that, you know, clarify that metaphor. And he also suggests in his course that we use each of the specifics to go beyond them. We have to use each specific thing that we either typically have a special love or special hate relationship with, and use that to go beyond the specialness to the, you know, the special interest, the separate interest, if you will, to the shared interest. And that's a very powerful thing. Synchronistically, I just got a little sneak preview of a video that's going to be played Thursday. And if anybody hasn't already signed up for the Foundation for Inner Peace Let's Discuss ACIM webinar series, you still can do that. And you can listen to and watch the prior recordings that have been going on for almost a year now. And you can go to acim.org/events and get to that place. And anyway, next Thursday, I'm pleased and honored to be moderating another webinar. And this will be with Judy Skutch Whitson, who is the publisher of the original Course in Miracles and at the Foundation for Inner Peace, and also Jerry Jampolsky, who is now 95 and still going strong, although he's, you know, has some physical challenges, but you can tell that his mind has been, you know, profoundly transformed as he and Judy are talking about their special relationship and how it has transformed into really a holy relationship with the Holy Spirit, and then that's how it's reflected in their specific relationship. And so anyway, it's going to be fun to see what they share in addition to the about half of the program, which will be a pre-recorded video, and then they'll have questions and answers after that. So
did you say Jerry Jampolsky?
Uh-huh.
Oh, cool. I love Jerry Jampolsky.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I finally got to talk with him the other day, which is a real treat, and I'll be able to help with that on Thursday. So I'm looking forward to that very much.
He is an amazing guy, and I'll tell you what, I've interviewed him a couple times, and I went out to the conference when I think it was his 90th birthday or something. Anyway, I went out to the conference of the attitudinal healing, and took the 3-day workshop to become an attitudinal healing circle to be able to do that. So, you know, I'm very very fond of Jerry and his work. So that'll be interesting and cool. And
I was just going to say, if you or anyone else is interested in submitting questions, you can do that through that. That forum, and you know, go to the FIP website, which is ACIM.org, and then you can submit questions for the webinar there, and for any other upcoming webinars.
Okay.
And they've tried to get to as many as they can. Of course, they'll take the ones that are probably most pertinent to the most people.
Very cool. I'm looking at the website, and it's not advertised on the website.
Not yet. Yeah,
okay.
It's kind of early this week. So.
I won't rush it. Okay. Anyway, so cool. So thank you. That's exciting. And that is at 2 o'clock p.m. Pacific time?
Pacific, uh-huh, okay. On Thursday.
So that would be, is that 5 o'clock Eastern?
Correct.
Yeah, okay, 5 o'clock Eastern. Okay. Very cool. And that is on, what day is it?
That's a Thursday.
Okay.
The 9th, yeah.
I might be able to just tap into that and play it through Gather, because we don't have anybody on at that time. And, you know,
great. That'd be fun.
Simple enough to plug in the microphone here and have people here listen. And, you know, love to share, love to share. So
oh, that's wonderful. Cool. Thank you.
Very cool. And so some of these are on here as recordings as well. This is great. So anyway, thank you, Bruce. I'm looking forward to that.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
My thoughts about that don't really mean anything, but I'm looking I'm really looking forward to it.
And it's, you know, what a great reminder is that, you know, it really isn't about the specifics, but it's taking those specifics. You know, in this case, the focus will be on the relationship that Jerry and Judy had over the years and how they, with the Course and, you know, listening to the Holy Spirit, were able to transform their relationship to ego to a relationship to the Holy Spirit. And you know, it's the task that we're all doing. I mean, so it's not like it's unique. It's not like they're special or we're special or anyone's special. But we use all of our specialist thoughts to get back to the generalizations that as we were just talking about, the early workbook lessons, you know, hint at, is that's the way out of the hell that we made, is to go from the separate interest to the shared interest, and to go from specialness to the holiness of the whole that we really are. And despite the high production value, holographic, illusory dream figures that we've identified with.
Exactly. All the noise signals that have just overwhelmed our imaginations and given us an idea that there's really something out there.
Exactly.
It's we can hone in on that, the singular one that is the GPS. I love it. We are reading, Bruce and I are reading the book called The Journey Home by Dr. Kenneth Wapnick, and this is an explanation or discussion of the obstacles to peace from chapter 19 of A Course in Miracles. And so according to my Kindle, we are 25% through the book. Can you believe it? So another
3 years or so, and we'll be on to the next thing, right?
Exactly. Well, you never know. time and space, you know, they're not in our court. So whatever happens, it does. So do you want to read? And
Sure. I have us in the printed version on, middle of page 128, but I'm going to pat back up a couple of paragraphs to the second bolded quote from chapter 19, which is, "Forgive me your illusions and release me from punishment for what I have not done." And that "have not done" is a key phrase in the Course, as we all realize, because if we had done something sinful, evil, or wicked, then the Course would be in big trouble, because then there wouldn't be any way out of that. And that's the ego's strategy and its propaganda. And it uses both the thoughts of this world and the projections of this world, which is the phenomenal world of space-time and matter and energy and bodies and people and stuff, quarks to quasars, that, you know, we think is the big deal. Our inner kindness teacher, a.k.a. Holy Spirit, says, wait a minute, maybe there's another way of looking at this. Hold on a second. Let's see if we can find a way that releases you from the dream of that. And by seeing what hasn't happened in truth being the eternal, unchangeable, and if anything changes, it can't be true. So that's our the mechanism and the divine logic, if you will, by which we arrive at the conclusion that none of us have done anything in truth, which is what our real being is. And that real being is like that quiet signal that we have to pull out of the noise of the ego's chatter, and, you know, all of its, you know, shrieking, you know, cacophonous voices that you know, bombard us from every direction in the world. But just beyond this world, there's that still small voice, if you will. It's like the GPS signal that we have to gradually, through mind training, pull out of that noise and begin locking onto that signal and finding the peace in that then reinforces our continued development of that trust. So anyway, Ken, Ken comments, just as A Course in Miracles version of the Lord's Prayer starts, "Forgive us our illusions, Father," and that's from chapter 16, section 7, paragraph 12, Jesus is asking us here that we forgive him the illusions of hatred, separation, sacrifice, and murder, punishment for what I have not done, that we have placed upon him. Psychologically speaking, there is a part of us that is always seeking to punish Jesus, first by seeing him as being punished on the cross. Since projection makes perception, we could not perceive Jesus as being punished on the cross had we not first wanted to have him be punished on the cross. Not just Christianity, but any religion that basically fosters the belief in separation, which is really based on an unconscious, unfounded guilt, huh?
Yeah. So when we look at you know, when the ego looks at Jesus and says, what the ego sees is an accuser. The ego looks at Jesus and sees, you know, someone who's there to get rid of him. It would get, destroy it, and you know, is up to, you know, knows what it's up to. So the idea, you know, that, you know, we want to get rid of the thing that's going to out us, is, you know, it's shocking, but I can see it completely. You know, this is why in the first place, you know, people didn't like what he was saying, because it was like, you know, he knew all the secrets, he knew everything, you know, how scary it would be to be with someone who you knew was fully aware of all your lies,
but saw them as meaningless, no big deal, and it's the no big dealness that is really the insult to the ego's made-up identity. That you know, that's what the ego takes offense with and has issue with, is that the idea that our individual identities don't mean anything, that our shared identity is the only true meaning. And that's why these early workbook lessons are so profound, even though they seem so simple, because it basically begins right from the get-go at dismantling our fraudulent assembly of little meaningless things into a bigger meaningless picture that makes no sense. I mean, it's kind of like that metaphor I was using to describe the GPS signal a moment ago. If you have, you know, dozens of people in a big auditorium that are right next to you shouting at you over and over again, while, you know, there's this small, quiet voice at the back of the auditorium way at the opposite end whispering to you, you know, it takes a while to begin to question that, other than the fact that there's no peace and there's no fulfillment and there's no happiness in listening to those loud shouting voices. I mean, it's a terrorizing, you know, horrific situation. But we're so accustomed to it. It's kind of like having a rock in your shoe. You know, if you walk with a rock in your shoe long enough, you know, you begin to think, well, that's how my foot's supposed to feel, you know?
Yeah, I know that.
But, you know, but then you take it out and say, oh, my foot feels better now. You know, it's like you actually finally stop and take it out. But anyway, I think it's kind of like, you know, that sort of thing. We need to gradually let go of our masochistic tendencies, you know, and which is really sadomasochism, because whatever we think about ourselves, we think about others, and vice versa. So, shall I finish
that? Yes, please do. Please do.
Okay. So, first, by seeing him as punished on the cross. Second, and then since projection makes perception, we could not perceive Jesus being punished on the cross had we not first wanted to have him be punished on the cross. Second, we indirectly believe we can punish Jesus by denying his teaching an example through our unforgiveness of others, ourselves, and him, not to mention making him into a symbol of suffering, sacrifice, and judgment. And I have to say that this movie that I watched, did I mention this last week, of the Mary Magdalene film?
No.
Oh, it's interesting. Yeah, I guess I was mentioning it to a different group. But anyway, yeah, there's a movie about the life of Jesus from Mary Magdalene's perspective. And I watched this past week, and I guess it was Saturday night last week. Anyway, it was kind of understated. It wasn't trying to do a lot. It was not trying to overreach what you could do in a couple hours and a story. But it had some really interesting ideas in it, particularly at the end where Mary Magdalene gave a monologue. And but they dispensed with a lot of the cliches and just kind of kept to a fairly good measure a lot of the ideas about shared interest and kindness. And anyway, but I think it was worth watching very much. And if you haven't seen it, then you might want to check it out. It just came out in the last year or two. Anyway, but the idea of suffering, sacrifice, and judgment, there was some of that got through, but there was other parts that was like, well, if this isn't our real identity, then how could suffering be real? I mean, it's something we made up and we made very realistic, and when, kind of reminds me what I learned from a fellow I met years ago named Jack Schwartz, who was tortured by the Nazis, and they put knitting needles in his arm years afterwards when he realized that the pain was a mental process, which is what Arden and Persig, Gary Renard's teachers, have said. It's not something that is truly physical, because there isn't anything truly physical. It doesn't mean that we deny our experience in the world. It's the last thing that the Course wants us to do. In fact, it says it's a particularly unworthy form of denial. But it does suggest that we at least question the interpretation that our egoic mind makes of those sensory data and the experience that we have of that. So whether it's physical pain or psychological pain, it really is, I think, worth looking at the whole thought system of suffering, sacrifice, and judgment, and seeing how we make everyone as symbols of those as we make ourselves symbols. And so we do the same thing to the religious figures that we ascribe ego intent or orientation with. And so that's why, strangely, the Course says we need to forgive Jesus or any other symbol that we would have helped with our healing of our mind.
Yeah, and because that still is a picture. It's not the truth.
Right.
So it's our continuing to think that there's a meaning that Jesus is something real, that is a person who came here to do things, is still, that's an illusion. That's not true. Nor is any other thing in the illusion. I know a lot of people get freaked out when you say that, but Jesus was not a real person either. And
only because none of us are.
Because none of us are real, yeah.
And that's the generalization that the Course suggests.
Exactly.
None of us are truly limited by space and time, then these characters that we've identified with that have, driver's licenses and social security numbers and file income taxes and have life histories and can rattle on and on about things that have happened to them, as specific people and with specific bodies and specific personalities, at some point, I think through sheer boredom, frustration, or agony of some sort in the mind, just say, enough of this. There must be a better way. And we begin questioning it. And that's what I think leads people to the Course, is the recognition that there must be a different identity. And we learn through practice that repetition over and over and over again of the trying out the shared interest instead of the separate interest, by trying the real identity rather than the substitute one. We're more peaceful.
Yeah.
And what do you know? We can't actually transform our identity completely at some point, but it's a gradual process that takes a lot of repetition, just like the GPS.
Absolutely, it does. So I'm going to go ahead and read the next paragraph.
Great.
So Ken says, I would think, however, that even people who do not experience a relationship with him have on some level been affected by him. It is very hard to grow up in the Western world without being affected by the figure of Jesus, as we see every day. It's, I mean, everywhere you look, right? Whether you are a Christian or a Jew, an atheist or a believer, it would be difficult to avoid the issues raised by this man who has become the greatest and most powerful symbol of God in the Western world. We can then understand that what happened in the crucifixion was the reenactment of the quote-unquote original crucifixion, the separation from God and destruction of Christ. Just as to the ego, God's quote-unquote sin was his perfect love as creator for the created, so too was Jesus' sin the perfect love of Christ for Christ. Therefore, the egos of the world, bound by their own insane thought system, well, this is just exactly what we were just saying, isn't it? The egos of the world, bound by their own insane thought system, must continually attempt to destroy and murder the capital L, love of capital H, heaven, in all its symbols and manifestations, for it represents their own demise. In two different passages in the text, Jesus comments very specifically on why the crucifixion was inevitable within the world's dream. And so here's the first one. Many thought I was attacking them, even though it was apparent I was not. An insane learner learns strange lessons. What you must recognize is that when you do not share a thought system, you are weakening it. Those who believe in it, therefore, perceive this as an attack on them. This is because everyone identifies himself with his thought system, and every thought system centers on what you believe you are. And that's from text chapter 6, section 5. And let's see, it's one of those many numbered lessons. Then he says also in chapter 13, I have said that the crucifixion is the symbol of the ego. When it was confronted with the real guiltlessness of God's Son, it did attempt to kill him. And the reason it gave was that guiltlessness is blasphemous to God. To the ego is God. And guiltlessness must be interpreted as the final guilt that fully justifies murder. So, you know, this is how the ego sees things. It cannot see innocence, and even the thought of innocence is a accusation to the ego, an accusation that what it is not real and true. And so it sees it as an attack. Any of our thoughts that we have that are thoughts that we're aligning with the Christ mind, that we're practicing forgiveness, we're looking for the good in things, we're looking for God in everything, we're looking for love in everything. Every time we do that, that says to the ego, wait a minute, you know, your thought system sucks. You don't know anything, and you are going to die. And because it's for the ego, its only sense of self is the objection that it has to whatever is happening. You know, like, you know, the torture, the person being tortured. The only reason that you suffer when you're being tortured is because you object to it. You have an opinion that it's a bad thing. You look at it and say, this is not bearable. I can't stand this. I don't like this. You know, torture is only torture if you see it in your mind as being something that is hurting you. And so, you know, I mean, there are people who think that physical torture is pleasant, and there are whole communities that are kind of based on this, you know, sadomasochism and this idea of, you know, hurt me and it makes me feel good. Why is that? How is that possible? Because they look at pain and don't see it as suffering. They see it as pleasure. It's a thought. And so if you can change your thought that much, to where you see pleasure in pain, you have to understand that your thoughts, these thoughts, although they are powerful, they are not real and changeable. They're not real, and you don't have to follow them or believe in them or suffer because of them. it's this identification with our thoughts. And, you know, the idea that we are this thing that really puts us in a place where, you know, crucifixion is not only acceptable, it's inevitable. So, you know, that's interesting and beautiful, the way that Jesus points this out to us.
Yeah. Yeah, the inevitability of the inner comfort is actually something I actually wrote something a little bit about when I first started reading the course back in the mid 80s, and I was just kind of inspired by the idea that I don't know what the writing is now, but I was trying to reflect on the idea that what's truly inevitable is that we will be at peace if we. You know, as we, and not if, but as we, over time, release what doesn't work. And so the inevitability really comes about because of the fact that, you know, we're dealing with an illusion, and how can something that in truth never happened maintain a grip on us? I mean, we can delay it, that awakening, for a long, long time, but the inevitability is that we will, at some point, see the light, and that's one of the things that's you know, pointed out in the course, is that, you know, you can you can punish yourself and you know, buy into the sacrifice and judgment thought system as long as you want, but at some point you're going to say, you know, do I really want to suffer like this? Do I really want to inflict that on myself and everyone that my mind reaches out to, you know, and say, why would I do that?
So, exactly. Why would I do that? And you know, because I'm insane?
Yeah, because we've listened to those shouting voices that are around us instead of the whispering voice from, you know, across the way. So shall I read on?
Sure.
Okay, so Ken comments, so for those who do not consciously relate to Jesus, I certainly would not recommend that they force him on themselves. But I think they should at least be open to the idea that there may be a part within themselves that they are not in touch with that does have these unforgiving feelings. Remember that in the Course, Jesus does not ask to believe in him. And there's a reference to the clarification of terms where that's brought up in Section 5 and Paragraph 6, sentence 6. But he does ask us several times to forgive him. So, you know, again, it could be whatever picture we have in our mind of a historical figure that, you know, is emblematic of sacrifice, particularly crucifixion, particularly, you know, the persecution, the crown of thorns, the, you know, the all that kind of, that whole story, you know. And that's basically the idea that we think there's some kind of guilt that is possible, and therefore somebody needs to suffer and be punished for it. And that's the ego's version of atonement. But the Course's version of atonement is completely different. It basically says, if that is based on something that changes, if that is based on a made-up story that, despite being incredibly photorealistic, 3D, holographically, you know, profoundly beyond technical brilliance, you know, seemingly real, if it's ultimately just made up, if it's just a fabrication of a mind that believes it was possible to split things apart, then forgiveness then is possible and also inevitable, and because it's like at some point we will want to voluntarily get off the suffering and condemnation bandwagon, because it doesn't work for us. and we're not at peace when we go down that road in the mind.
Yeah, and actually forgiving Jesus is saying the story's not real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just recognizing, because that's all forgiveness is. It's not saying, you know, oh, you did a bad thing and that needs to be, you know, I need to let that go. The forgiveness is really just saying, you know, this story is not real.
Yeah, exactly. And it is an emblematic or you know, symbolic representative of, you know, the Western world's, you know, spiritual authority figure. If we think of it in those terms, what we're really doing is we're basically saying, I give up wanting to persecute the representative of the leadership of my spiritual, you know, system, and ascribing to that an egoic intention and a condemning, judgmental identity that is hell bent on persecution and retribution in the sense of sacrifice and suffering. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So you want to
and this world is the sacrifice. I mean, we're already, according to the Course's, you know, metaphysics, we're already believing in sacrifice just by believing that we're separate from each other and from our Creator. That's like, it's so profoundly, you know, evident when we start looking at it and begin through the repetition again of seeing how crazy this thought system is that we bought into, and then, you know, loosening our identification with it. And then it's like, wow, that is, I mean, within the true logic, the supreme eternal logic of seeing that, you know, nothing happened in truth, and everyone merits that forgiveness, including the symbols in our mind of you know, what we think of as our guidance, our inner guidance.
Exactly. Absolutely. So you want to continue reading, or you want me to?
Sure. So will you learn the freedom that I taught by teaching freedom to your brother and so releasing me. And that's from chapter 19. So we teach freedom to everyone around us, and that releases our inner kindness teacher to do what it needs to do. So Ken says, this is the same idea that in the parable of the Last Judgment in Matthew, which is apparently 25:40 in probably King James Bible, which is, quote, what you do to the least of these you do unto me, unquote. By releasing our brothers or sisters from the bondage of guilt that our projections placed in them, we are also releasing Jesus from these projections. Never forget that minds are joined, and so what we do to one member of the sonship is inevitably done to all of them. Again, not that we are responsible for other people's choices for guilt, but that we are responsible for our perceptions of these choices. Attacking other people reinforces our own guilt, which in turn reinforces our belief that we are undeserving of God's love. Therefore, the ego must keep Jesus' love away from us, thereby imprisoning him through preventing his love because of our unacceptance of it from embracing us. On the other hand, by forgiving others, which is the meaning of teaching freedom to your brother, our guilt is undone, which then allows us to accept God's love through Jesus. This is he, in effect, his love in our minds. Oh, thus is he. In effect, his love in our minds released as well.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's all connected, isn't it? So, I mean, how can the symbols of the figures of, you know, what we think of as, you know, spiritual archetypes or leaders or you know, luminaries or whatever, you know, symbols or you know, representative figures we use in our minds that denote spiritual enlightenment or freedom or whatever, if those are wrapped up and entangled with the ego baggage of suffering and separation and punishment and guilt and death, it's like, well, because that's the whole premise of a separate identity, then, you know, we're going to have a pretty, you know, confused mind. And it's so these early workbook lessons, again, are helping us to unconfuse ourselves by questioning the very thought system that ascribes, punishing intent to those religious symbols in our mind, in particular Jesus.
Yeah,
since he's such a popular one in the Western world.
It is interesting to me that right now in our political world, there's been a turn to the evangelists. There's like a whole, like the radical Christian right becoming more involved in politics, although they always kind of have been. Reaffirming. Every day I see a picture of the president with some evangelical group, or people are praying for him and touching him, and it's like they've really caught on to this, whatever this thing is, this phenomena, being somehow caught up in their identification. And the identification of the politics of this country and other, other places in the world, how that whole idea of the connection with God is being kind of perverted to being an acceptance of, politicians or their policies. And it's interesting to see how that now this is being used as a justification for all the the things that that Jesus himself more than likely would have not been for. If you ask what would Jesus do in these situations, you're seeing a picture of Jesus that he would approve of these things that we think are so horrible, and yet that's not what Jesus would have done at all, ever. So
I think
crazy.
It's real easy to get caught up in the level of confusion of thinking that that Jesus in A Course in Miracles has anything to do with the Jesus of the Bible, the Christian Bible, because the author of the inspiration for the channeled work, if you want to call it that, that Helen Schuckman took down, and Bill Thetford, typed up the notes on, that inspiration, if anyone actually reads what it says, it's pretty obvious that the two thought systems represented by that voice that Helen, profound faithfulness got the message through, beyond the words, and I think it's anyone who studied the Course for a while would attest to that. It's obvious that thought system has nothing to do with the sin, guilt, fear thought system of any conventional formal religion, including all the various Christian sects and so forth and offshoots and denominations, but you could pick any other religion that basically makes a cult of personality and has a celebrity culture around religious figures and makes guru or idol worship and dogmas and behavior more important than the releasing of everyone from unconscious and unfounded guilt. I mean, it's a stark contrast, and it's not condemning anyway, because I think a lot of people come to the non-dual metaphysics of the Course and things like it. There's Advaita Vedanta and a number of other teachings. In fact, in the Manual for Teachers says this is just one of many thousands of forms of the universal teaching that the Course represents. But so it's not about the form. It's never about the form. It's always about the choice in the mind to go beyond the idolatry and the worship of the symbol. It's kind of like the old classic thing of, do you, make a shrine to the finger that's pointing to the moon, or do you look at the moon that it's pointing to?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And yeah, I mean, really, what I was saying, though, is that even if you read the story of Jesus in the Bible, the person and personality that he was not what he's being projected as in the world. And you know, I mean, if you looked at, you know, what kind of a person he was in the world, he was, you know, completely accepting and loving and forgiving, and you know, he had, you know, all you know, completely opposite point of view than what he's being seen as through the eyes of the ego. It's just craziness, but you know, Christianity has nothing to do with Jesus. Is the problem, you know, the actual problem with it. Even if he was a real person who walked on the earth and had a life and did the things that, but of course, none of that's true. It's all part of the illusion. It's all a story of a past, you know, it's an idea in our mind.
Right. We're forgiving a symbol here, and that's, I think, what Ken is getting at.
Yes, and that's exactly it.
We're forgiving the symbolic structure in our mind that represents a thought system of suffering and damnation and condemnation, and recognizing that that has never worked for us and never will, and choosing the real alternative instead.
Exactly, exactly. So let's see. So I'll continue on reading.
Okay,
this is again from The Obstacles to Peace. I am within your holy relationship, yet you would imprison me behind the obstacles you raise to freedom and bar my way to you. And that is a quote from Jesus in The Obstacles to Peace. And says, to state it again, we do not have to consciously work on a relationship with Jesus. He will show up by himself when we release him from the prison of guilt in which we placed him. And we do that by releasing those whom we have been attacking, our brothers, right? This must then mean that if we are afraid of Jesus and his peace because of the threat he poses to our individuality, a surefire way of protecting our egos from him is to attack others. As he teaches us in the Manual for Teachers, a passage we have already quoted under the first obstacle, God's peace, this is from the Manual for Teachers, God's peace can never come where anger is, for anger must deny that peace exists. Who sees anger as justified in any way or in any circumstance proclaims that peace is meaningless and must believe that it cannot exist. In this condition, peace cannot be found. That's from the Manual for Teachers, section 20. And so we become angry. And so we are made safe from Jesus. Now, how simple that is, right?
It's just listening to the shouting voices of the ego all around us instead of through a tremendously disciplined, repetitive practice, listening to that whispered voice from the other side of that place in our mind. Yeah.
Exactly.
Should I finish off the chapter?
Yeah.
Okay, I think we've got our time. Yet it is not possible to keep away one who is there already. And in him, capital H, let's just like the one who is capitalized, it is possible that our communion, where we are joined already, will be the focus of the new perception that will bring light to all the world contained in you. And so again, from chapter 19. And Ken comments, the quote, one who is there already, one who in capitals, is the Father who, also in capitals, is talked about in the previous paragraph. Therefore, it is in God that we are already joined with Jesus. Here we find the word, quote, communion, unquote, appearing again. In that communion, which is eternal, Jesus has already joined with us, reminding us that we are forever one with God. All that is needed is for us to remove the obstacles of guilt and attack that prevent us from being aware of this his presence. Therefore, it is this communion, joining with Jesus through forgiveness, that is the focus of this new perception, that is the true perception of the vision of Christ, which will bring light to all the world. As Jesus teaches in the workbook, and this is from workbook lesson 34, which is one of the two that Ken says, if you're going to be stranded on a desert island, good to memorize, 5 and 34. Peace of mind is clearly an internal matter. It must begin with your own thoughts and then extend outward. It is from your peace of mind that a peaceful perception of the world arises. And then Ken concludes the chapter with, once again, we can see Jesus' call to us that we be instruments of this light in order to bring it to the minds of God's sons. This is the only way that peace will ever come. Peace cannot come by changing something on the level of the body. It cannot come by changing structures. It can come only by changing our minds, and in that way, we can truly affect the minds of other people. This light is not in the world, nor of it. Rather, the light is in us, in our minds, that are one with each other, with Jesus, and with God. So, there's the end of chapter 5, the second obstacle, the belief that the body is valuable for what it offers.
Pretty amazing, isn't it? And just when you see how we've been fooling ourselves, and we don't believe it.
Yeah, it's such a convincing, you know, powerful hologram. I keep coming back to, you know, when I watch. We went to go see the latest Star Wars movie the other day in the theater, and on a matinee day kind of thing. And you know, regardless of where you see those movies with all the special effects, if you just kind of pay attention to the other credits that roll past, and you realize, my gosh, there's hundreds and hundreds of people typically that are involved in making these, you know, the CGI, the computer generated imagery, and all the teams of animators and you know, map painters, and you know, the sheer amount of technical wizardry that goes into making something seem believable. In especially a movie with a lot of special effects these days, and even those without them, you know, just the quality of the acting, the you know, there's the set design and the costumes and it's just like you get involved in a movie, you're like, gosh, you forget you're watching a movie, and that's the whole point, is to lose yourself in that dream and that fantasy, and. But we walk out of the theater, or we turn off the TV or our phones or whatever we're watching this thing on, you know, whatever the thing happens to be, the production, and we forget that it's still going on. So when I first watched the movie Inception a few years back when I was living in Southern Oregon, and walked out of the theater, I had this like aha moment. It's like, wow. Then that movie had like several different levels of dreaming, and I thought, gee, now I'm just back to one level of dreaming. As I walked out of the theater.
Or just step back to noticing one level of things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because it's like, okay, now the movie's over, so now I'm just, you know, in the one, I've dropped out of all those other movies, now I'm just in my movie, you know, my dream of being a person. But it was kind of a cool, surreal, those virtual reality kinds of films, I think, can be really helpful. Seen properly, and just remembering that it's all made up. It's just an enormous hoax with production values that are beyond staggering. But because we all contributed to it, and our minds are so powerful, we're able to believe that this is the real deal, and that we actually pulled off this fantasy where we appear to be inhabiting separate bodies with separate personalities and you know, having separate stories and separate lives, and so convincing. I mean, who would question it? And Kim says, you know, some of those brilliant minds in our world's history have this has gone completely unnoticed. You know, because it's such a profoundly convincing holographic movie, 3D movie dream that is, you know, staggering in its complexity. From the microcosmic to the macrocosmic, and all the specifics that ensnare us and you know, beg for identification, but that begging is just a reflection of the tiny man idea.
So, yeah. Anyway.
Well, we've run out of time.
To
go into chapter 6, and I'm always enjoying these conversations with you, Lynn, and look forward to the next one next Saturday.
So. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and I'm actually going to be taking off and doing some stuff right after this because it's my daughter's birthday, or yesterday was my daughter's birthday, but we're celebrating today. So
great. And I'm going to go to Tim Wiseland Corona's Saturday morning class next.
Sounds good. All right, yeah. My love, I'll talk to you next week. Have a great
week.
All right.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
All right. So I am going to thank you, Miss Sharon. It's good to see you. Welcome Carrie and Iris and Nigel and Allison and Dove and all you folks out there listening on the radio. God bless you all. Turning this mic over to you, Carrie and Iris. This mic is all yours.